Good evening, Dr. Anguera, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. This is the 2nd of March, 2024. I am going to offer a lecture tonight on a comparison between normal agentic behavior and the behavior of biochemical systems. So it's a huge reach because I'm trying to do a metaphysical comparison from how much we know about the regulation, for example, of biochemical pathways. And then recall that as research scientists, we are placing our description into what we observe in nature. So that event itself is an agentic event. The way that we describe it and the terms we use, the mechanisms, and the way we've used chemistry and biology and physics all together to explain the living system, particularly the human. So, interestingly enough, the human also has a component that is different from other living systems, including what is living that composes that human being, that is the cells and the tissues in the body. And the big difference there is that the human has an intellect and is capable not only of organizing the way that they're describing what they observe in nature, and therefore we research scientists don't differ because we're all dealing with phenomenological events, but also on what perturbations might occur to that living system based on free choice of the will. Now, I know that sounds hard to put all together in just that one sentence like I did, but just remember that all of our choices, such as dietary choices, lifestyle, exercise, where we live, how we live, all have a huge impact on health and welfare of each individual. And that's why disease states are so complex, because the living history of each individual is unique to that person because of agentic choices they made through life. So even if you go and get a scan and you are diagnosed with some particular disease, or you're lucky and you don't have any diagnoses because you're quite healthy, the system that's being looked at by those different means, using different kinds of equipment and using, of course, blood draws and doing blood panels and all of that to try to determine your overall health, all the electrophysiology, et cetera, all the things that are normally done in a medical framework. They're only measuring what is candidly most likely to have a dramatic effect on health. Whereas when you listen to authentic biochemistry, you learn that it is far more complex. And by complex, I don't just mean that it's, you know, really, really a lot of information all at once. That's not really what I'm saying. Complex meaning it's made up of multiple integrative components that are all functioning together as events. So we act like glycolysis is different from deoxygenated pentose phosphate shunt because there's different enzymes, even though there are intermediates they share. We act like nucleic acid biosynthesis is unique from amino acid catabolism. But again, those two pathways converge often. But consider that the entire living system, what maintains the living system itself, is a complex analysis of everything that has occurred to that living system for its longevity. So epigenetic alterations, mutations, any modifications in gene expression in a, say, in a different cell system or organ system, the turnover of cells in any given major physiological components in the body are all going to have an imprint of that individual. And you know, there's no way to measure all of those events because those are events. They're always changing as you're measuring them. There isn't any freeze, frame. Look at this, and now we understand everything that's going on in the system. So sometimes I like to do a little bit of metaphysical comparison between something very mundane, like the control over movement of people, and how that can be altered by a certain stimulus. And I'm going to introduce one here. And then looking at what kinds of regulation occurs inside the body just in one very central metabolic pathway, and how that metabolic pathway affects all the other metabolic pathways. And we're not going to be able to talk about everything, obviously, but I will give you enough detail for you to hopefully be convinced of that. Now, I did do a first draft lecture on this exact topic with very much the same information, but I've rewritten it earlier this evening, and I removed it because it lacked some of the important connecting points that I hope to be able to just speak off the cuff when I was doing the lecture. But when I listened to the lecture, I realized I didn't make the really essential points. So that's why I'm redoing it. So if you have an older version of this, you can listen to it if you want to, but this is the one I want you to hear. All right, sorry for all the time to explain what we're doing here, but let's go. And I'm going to speak really fast because there's a lot of information here I want to get at. Okay. First of all, I've established myself, my point of view, many premises in lifetime. And I'm a research scientist, so some of those premises are going to impact the way I look at what I study. So even when I was still an undergraduate, the inferences that I drew basically come into two competing, but maybe only contrarian, not contradictory categories. So I'm going to schematize them now. And these categories follow the basic structure of practical reason. So here we go. I often have inferred from what I reasoned from an established set of empirical evidences that my new experiences, could mean observations in the lab, could be decoded by whatever basic law it was held under. Okay, that empirical evidence was held under. Now, that the product of this reasoning were clearly inductive premises, I don't think I need to exhaustively interrogate here, because it is in my view that the inexperience of youth, so the younger you are as a research scientist, the inexperience of youth is driven toward inductive logic more often, since the total corpus of all experience in the laboratory and knowledge from the literature and thoughts extracted thereof are limited in both scope and in what you could call a reiteration of phenomena when one has less years than many more years studying the overall corpus of the scientific literature and having practiced in it as an experimental scientist, not just as a professor. Now, I'm going to now go to a human agentic system, and I'm going to eventually tie it together with biochemical pathway. So bear with me, okay? This is kind of an experiment itself. So I'm going to use this example. I had another example in the first draft of this, but this one's better for reasons I hope you'll understand. So, okay, here we go. Every time, just imagine this in nature. Tomorrow's Sunday. So every time a church bell chimes a certain 12 times, a certain church bell 12 times, meaning noon, there is a massive movement of the public square population to go into the church for that mass at noon, that Catholic mass at noon. Now, these people are there to be allowed into the church, so the bell tower is there to regulate their flow with a specific direction and force dependent upon the number of parishioners and maybe factors such as the weather or the time of year in general. Now, my assumption is that whenever the clock strikes 12, anyone gathered in that square who intends to enter the church will do so because they have chosen to be there for that purpose. Now, I could then suggest as a premise to a logical argument that given this cause-effect relationship, if the bell struck 12 times earlier, I don't know what time, let's say 10 a.m., fewer people would have inhabited the square, so the overall movement would be less. However, the timing being incorrect may nevertheless alert these people to reconsider moving into the church because they know it's too early, because they have the power of reason. So they would have to make a free choice of will based on their interests and on their awareness that basically the time is wrong, but the chime was correct. The stimulus was correct to go into the church. So they would exercise their free will and thus consider the changing conditions as yet a new factor in moving where they may have readily gone if the time was right. You know, the bells rang 12 times and it was noon, right? Now, for those who move without regard to the hour of the day, but only because the clock struck 12, would be responding in what I would call a conditioned behavioral stimulus, which biochemical mechanisms don't work because of behavior. They work because of biochemical signatures. Now, in behavioral psychology, we call that sometimes the Pavlovian response, right? But remember, the Pavlov studied dog behavior, and dogs do not have human free choice of the will. So, take that for what it's worth. It is a predictive assumption that could I generate both a valid and sound argument by concluding if the church bell rang 12 times inappropriately, the people assembled might assume that Mass is earlier that day and would not want to miss it. Could I do that? After all, this is an inductive reasoning movement. Because every 12 chimes are heard, Mass begins. So why wouldn't that be the case this time? See where I'm going with this? It's a huge metaphor, basically. Now, you know what will happen. I'm about to invoke the distinction between valid argument and sound. Premise one, 12 bell chimes occur, and they are used to announce the Mass. Premise two, the assembled crowd respond to the conditioned stimulus. Conclusion, some component of the faithful would flock into the church, thus being there at the wrong time, even though the stimulus sounded, we'll use this word, authentic. Now, the argument is valid, but it's not sound, obviously. At least one of the premises is not true. That's what makes the argument unsound. You know, the only thing for an argument to be valid is that the premises connect to the conclusion. Doesn't mean that it's sound, meaning it could be a total mistake because the premises are not true, right? So here are the untrue premises, obviously, number two. Right? This assembled crowd will respond to a conditioned stimulus as if that's the only thing they could do. Okay? And you know that's not the case, right? So why does the argument fail? Well, obviously, the answer to the question is a lot deeper because it requires a knowledge of the strength of the conditioning of the people, the hearing the bell, over the faith of the parishioners. And all of this is going to be very, very, very complex, antigenic, and be related to free choice of the will. Right? Governed by it, I would say. Now, if I'm right, this sets up a paradox. And I'll present it as a new formal argument in what I call the dialectical characters. Thesis, 12 chimes mean Mass time. Antithesis, The faithful plan to attend Mass, but they know it's the wrong time. Synthesis? No synthesis. You can't make a synthesis of those two contradictory statements. So that would be called an antinomy. That means against the law of the excluded middle. You've heard me talk about it. And basically what that means is you could argue for either premise, but you can't argue for both at the same time, same place. That violates the contradiction of logic, right? So that's the law of logic, pneuma. Now, what can I say about deductive reasoning? That was all under an inductive reasoning point of view. I alluded to the deductive at the beginning. Now, in abstraction, the deductive argument reads, since there is a highly reproducible connection with a basic law being followed, I start thinking more and more about biochemistry now, even under a new event ontology, such as stress response, that law will be followed, and there will be empirical evidence used, that is via, for example, pattern recognition in the cell, to support the premise upon experimentation, meaning an alteration of metabolism to deal with the new phenomena. And if the alteration of metabolism is not appropriately deployed, the system will shut down, for example, an hyperinflammatory response. See what I'm saying here? See where there's a connection. Now, in our case, the deduction would be if the clock strikes 12, even though it's 10 a.m., the faithful will follow the rule and expect to be welcomed into Holy Mass, okay? So that would be a simple deduction. But the same dialectic stands, and the result is the same. There's no synthesis. And antinomy, once again, is the only achieved result, right? You cannot say one thing or another about it. Now, the example demonstrates this ordered regulation via stimuli and then reception and response can be overruled by human will. The event is in sequence, but the temporality is not followed, and thus the people who enter that church early will probably not have a Holy Mass, but rather will have to wait 2 hours while a larger group assembles outside in confusion. So the entire regulation is lost. The religious service might be canceled, very likely, or otherwise disrupted because the system operates outside of that highly organized administration. Now, compare that event to the control of that colossus of the mammalian system. Now, here it is. High insulin to glucagon ratios decrease cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinases, which alter the phosphorylation state many metabolic enzymes. Phosphofructokinase kinase 1 is one of those, and it's allosterically activated by a sugar fructose 2,6 bisphosphate, which itself is synthesized by the bifunctional PFK2 FBPase2, but only when that protein is dephosphorylated. Glycolysis is favored then. However, in cardiac muscle and specifically in skeletal muscle, and to some extent in adipose, AMP kinase phosphorylates the bifunctional enzyme at a unique serine residue, which induces the PFK2 activation over the phosphatase activity, thus stimulating glycolysis and overcoming, for example, in the skeletal muscle, the potential, or in a tumor, the potential for hypoxia. Hypoxia renders the mitochondrial electron transport chain oxidative phosphorylation pathway essentially non-functional. You know why? Because molecular oxygen is the ultimate electron acceptor, and it has to be ultimately reduced to H2O. So with depleted O2, as in stress and heavy skeletal muscle contraction, or in a tumor, glycolysis must be stimulated as AMP kinases rise, as adenosine monophosphate levels rise. And AMP also controls PFK1 directly. Continuing, the activation of adenylate cyclase by glucagon triggers the synthesis of cyclic AMP, of course, which then allosterically dissociates two suppressor domains of the cyclic AMP protein kinase, thus activating the protein kinase domain activity, which phosphorylates a bifunctional fructose 2,6 bisphosphatase kinase. the one we just mentioned, thus converting it to the phosphatase, which removes fructose 2,6-bisphosphate that would have otherwise allosterically activated PFK1. So cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase, also phosphorylates PFK1, and further inhibiting it along with ATP, acting again as an allosteric inhibitor. At the same time, you know, ATP binds to the unique substrate site. So PFK1 is a tetramer with each of its subunits possessing two allosteric sites for ATP binding, one substrate, and one is the inhibitor site. So ATP, same molecule, but different sites on the protein, binds to the inhibitor site when the tetramer is in a T state, which is less active. When ATP binds to each subunit allosteric site, it completely conforms the enzyme to the full T10 state that can no longer bind the second substrate, fructose 6-bisphosphate, basically rendering the enzyme inactive because of that covalent modification. Now, this is how ATP controls glycolytic flux via what is referred to as mitochondrially based respiratory control. Now, AMP competes for the allosteric site and brings the enzyme back to the more active R relaxed state. That can be actually graphed with PFK activity on the y-axis and increasing fructose 6-phosphate on the x-axis. And what you see at low ATP, the enzyme has a hyperbolic kinetic. You increase ATP concentration for the sigmoidal kinetics. That means it's allosterically regulated. Very sensitive to minor changes. Right, that's what a sigmoid kinetic will give you. Now, substrate cycling also controls the PFK1 balance, as there is a unique enzyme, fructose 1,6-bisphosphatase, which is actually a gluconeogenic enzyme, which also works as a mechanism to control influx of fructose 6-phosphate into the oxidative pentose phosphate pathway for NADPH production for the synthesis of ribose 5-phosphate for nucleotide biosynthesis. You see how fructose 6-phosphate is a substrate for both the aldolase and the transketolase reactions. So that's how you get glycolysis and OPP being regulated. You understand this, right? Also understand the oxidative pentose phosphate pathway produces NADPH. That's necessary for nucleotide biosynthesis as well, but also what else? For cholesterologenesis and fatty acid synthesis. Any anabolic synthesis is reductive biosynthesis. Remember that, okay? So you have to worry about the aldolase and glycolysis, the transketolase and reactions in the OPP. This is all part of the regulation of glycolysis. Now, there are also control points in glycolysis relative to, of course, glucokinase and hexokinase, the glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate dehydrogenase, and the pyruvate kinase. And those all feed into PFK1 indirectly. And I can detail those again. I've already talked about them. But right now, I just want to get to my final points here. And I'll start it out by asking basically a question and answering my own question. Many metabolic diseases, diabetes, for example, are fundamentally dysfunctional lipid metabolism, although carbohydrate homeostasis, in particular serum glucose levels, are more commonly linked to the disorder, since glycolysis is the most ubiquitous pathway in the oxidation of glucose, along with the OPP being of prime importance. As I said, its regulation is essential to normal metabolism, but conversely, pathophysiology. Now, fatty acid metabolism also plays an important role in glycolytic and gluconeogenic regulation, obviously, as well. Long-chain fatty acyl-CoAs are metabolized in the liver via the mitochondria-based beta oxidation. Before entry into the mitochondria, fatty acyl-CoAs can even regulate cytosolic metabolism via allosteric and non-allosteric mechanisms. Because the products of fatty acid oxidation include NADH and FADH2, which, of course, are going to be used to drive ATP synthesis and support gluconeogenesis in the fasting liver. What effect, here's my question, would you expect cytosolic fatty acyl-CoAs would have on PFK1 in the fasting liver? Answer now. I'm kidding. I'll give you the answer. The enzyme PFK1 catalyzes, again, the first committed step of glycolysis. It's regulated by a complex array of all those allosteric effectors I told you about. There is a direct, potent, and reversible inhibition of purified muscle PFK1 by low micromolar concentrations of long-chain fatty acyl-CoAs with an apparent KI of 1 micromolar, which is a good low level. Now, in sharp contrast, short-chain acyl-CoAs, palmitoyl-carnitine, and palmitic acid itself in the presence of free coenzyme A reduced had no effect. Remarkably, magnesium AMP, magnesium ADP, but not magnesium ATP, protected PFK1 against inhibition by palmitoyl-CoA, indicating the acyl-CoAs regulate PFK1 activity in concert with cellular high-energy phosphate status. Furthermore, incubation of PFK1 with C14 palmitoyl-CoA resulted in a robust acylation of the enzyme that could be reversed by incubation with a thioesterase, which is no surprise, the APT1 gene product. Now, APT1 reversed palmitoyl-CoA mediated inhibition of PFK1 activity. Mass spec analysis of palmitoylated PFK1 revealed four sites of acylation. I'm not going to name them all, but there are four different cysteine residues. Furthermore, PFK1 was inhibited by a compound called X-hexadecyl-CoA, which is a non-hydrolyzable palmitoyl-CoA analog. That demonstrates that covalent acylation of PFK1 is not required for the inhibition. In fact, tryptic footprinting suggested that S-hexadecyl-CoA induced a conformational change in PFK1. So both palmitoyl-CoA and that inhibitor S-hexadecyl-CoA increased the association of PFK1 with calcium calmodulin, which attenuates the binding of palmitoylated PFK1 to the membrane vesicles. Collectively, what all these results say is that fatty acyl-CoA modulates phosphofructokinase activity through both covalent and non-covalent interactions, thus regulating glycolytic flux and enzyme membrane localization via the branch point metabolic node that mediates lipid flux through anabolic and catabolic pathways. Now consider if I answer that question. Now consider if GTP was used to phosphorylate PFK2 epiPase2 rather than ATP. That would result in an uncoupling of the ATP administration over glycolysis via bioenergetics and, of course, mitochondrial respiration. It would ultimately require a whole new set of kinases and phosphatases with their own unique regulation. We do not find this. So it would ultimately require a great new reorganization of regulation. Now go back to the church bell. The church bell is the regulator of the mass, and ATP is the regulator over intermediary metabolism. ATP-mediated control over a network of intermediary metabolism, just put it bluntly. So what can I say? Free will actually will ultimately alter the regulation of both the metaphor and the metabolism. How? People choose to pay attention to stimuli and make decisions that control the power of flux through a system. Each person has an agentic potential and thus decides on the overall result, but in the biochemical regulated system as well. All is functioning under tight genetic and biochemical mechanisms that themselves have basically zero tolerance or very low tolerance for a massive change in flow of activity and circuitry, like the metaphor of the mass did. I therefore conclude that although one may use deductive or inductive reasoning to judge the validity and soundness of any argument, including arguments such as hypothetical deductions to do experiments, and that would thus resolve the critique of pure reason versus pure empiricism for finding overall truth in the world, neither pure reason nor pure empiricism is adequate. You could argue that one could draw both inductive and deductive reasoning together, but again, consider that an antinomy, at least I do. If deduction requires induction and vice versa, but neither system is sound, how can you say that any combination thereof would necessarily be able to be found? I mean, would work. But in the cell, the only effect on human reason is on mood and on the overt choice of diet, exercise, and lifestyle. And yet all those agentic appointments alter the entire metabolic regulatory system. We're well aware, think of obesity. So what is my overall solution to this discussion? It was hidden way at the beginning of it. The entire system is decided by free choice of the will. All right, I don't know if I went over, but no, perfect. This is Dr. Dan Guerra on Saturday evening saying bye for now. Hope you enjoyed that. Bye.